It's Paul Smolin, MD, your PEDcast host, bringing you informative and entertaining knowledge on a wide range of parenting and child health topics. You have parenting questions. He has answers. It's portable, practical pediatrics on your schedule. And here is your PEDcast host, Dr. Paul Smolin.
Welcome to another edition of Portable Practical Pediatrics. From the womb to the W-2, if the subject involves children, we take it on here. Now, a few months ago, I started a new series of PEDcasts I called Interesting Conversations with Parents. And I must say, these posts have been particularly popular with my listeners. The parents of the children I take care of are so interesting and curious and informed. They bring up the most interesting things in our time together in the office. These parents never cease to amaze me, and I must share some of these conversations with you, my blogging audience. In today's PEDcast, I'm going to bring a few more of these recent interesting conversations I've had with parents in the past month. So sit back and enjoy these conversations. Conversation one. A few days ago, I was doing a checkup of a young school-aged child. His mom was with him, and the conversation turned to his peanut allergy. Unfortunately, this is a conversation I have all too often these days. I know that this is an emotionally charged topic anytime the subject of food allergy comes up. And why not? Peanut allergy reactions are the most common trigger for severe, life-threatening food reactions in America today. And parents know that. No wonder parents get so freaky about the subject. I would too, especially considering that their children often are eating away from home where their parents can't supervise their food. It's very frightening. During our conversation, this mom turned to me and asked, "Have you heard of a menu card?" she asked. Well, actually, I had not. She explained to me that this is a card that the family or child takes to the restaurant to inform the chef that one of their diners has a life-threatening food allergy. I subsequently learned that they are also called chef cards. Well, this was the first that I had heard of these cards, but I'm glad she told me about them. They sound like a great idea, and they are becoming more and more commonly used. From there, our conversation turned to food testing, and specifically food challenges to diagnose food allergy or determine whether these allergies had disappeared. A food challenge is the ultimate way allergists determine that someone is not allergic. I was telling this mom of a growing trend that I have read and heard about from parents, that of testing children with suspected food allergy, not in an allergist's office or a health facility, but rather in their family car outside a health facility in case a child does have a serious reaction. You got it right. These parents drive to, let's say, an emergency room, give Junior some suspected food that he might be allergic to in the car out in the parking lot, and if there's no reaction, they do nothing. But if he does start to get a reaction, they're right there. Well, this practice is even mentioned in this New York Times article on childhood food allergy I have linked to in the SMO notes on this PEDcast. I guess this practice makes sense, but I'm not endorsing it. And while we're talking about foods and allergens, just for fun, try this food allergy quiz I came across during my research for this PEDcast. I learned a few new things taking it, and I'll bet you will too. Now make sure you look up the foods you are unsure of. Conversation number two. Well, it's spring now, but it's still cold in Charlotte when I'm recording this, which means it's cold and flu season. And last week I was talking to a family of a sick child whose family originated from India. The child had a lower respiratory illness and a bad cough. Well, after I did my assessment, I came to the conclusion that he had an uncomplicated viral illness, requiring nothing more than symptomatic treatment and some tender, loving care. I went through the usual symptomatic measures that I usually recommend, honey, Vicks, a humidifier for the cough, saline for the nose, and chicken soup as a natural form of aspirin. Well, I realized I had put my foot in my mouth. As I uttered the chicken soup words, I realized that this family might be vegetarian. And sure enough, they were. But this mom quickly replied, "No worries. We have our Indian vegetarian version of chicken soup for sickness." She said it is a soup made with lentil broth, curry, turmeric, and garlic. She insisted it was as effective as chicken soup. Well, after she left, I did a little research to find vegetarian equivalents for traditional chicken soup, and I found two groups of recipes, one from our Jewish friends, of course, and an Indian version, of course, just like this mother said. I have put links to a few of them in the Smo Notes at the end of this post. My understanding is that the broth of chicken soup contains elements of the chicken's bone marrow that give it the anti-inflammatory feel-better effect. For vegetarian versions, I think vegetables and spices may do the same thing. The final interesting conversation for this podcast occurred actually with a child, not a parent. It was a routine visit for a sore throat and a fever, where, of course, I obtained a throat culture to determine if this child had a bacterial infection from group A beta hemolytic strep, what we call strep throat, a really mean, potentially dangerous germ that often invades children's throats. We do what most pediatricians do, collect two specimens from the throat and first do a rapid detection test, and then, if that test is negative, follow up with a traditional throat culture. Since the rapid strep sometimes misses children with only a little bit of strep in their throats. His rapid test was indeed negative, so I was telling him and his mother that we would now culture his germs the old-fashioned way to make sure we didn't miss the germ, the strep germ, on the rapid test. The young man asked me how we grew the germ. So I told him that we put his germs, called plating them, on an agar, a jello-like substance with sheep's blood in the agar. He was shocked and exclaimed, "Why sheep?" I knew that it was important to have red blood cells in the agar because they serve as the germ food and provide a visible pattern of red cell destruction that is caused by the strep germ. So the technologist or the doctor can tell what kind of germ it is. Group A strep, the germ of strep throat, breaks up the red cells and changes them from a red color to an easy-to-see transparent color in the agar. But why sheep's blood? To this child, this test sounded more like a religious ceremony than a lab test. So I did a little study and found that blood agar is still used for the culture of strep, but actually any animal's red blood cells can be used. Sheep blood just seems to still be the standard. I did remember that different types of animals have different size red blood cells with their own unique properties. I remember that from medical school. I distinctly remember a hematology exam in med school being shown camel red blood cells under a microscope and being asked what was up. It turns out that sheep red blood cells are very small and tough, maybe giving them good properties for this blood agar strep test. But those camel red blood cells, they are huge. Well, after he left, I thought it was great that this young man was interested in the why of his lab test and had the gumption and interest to ask. I think this young man is going places. Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing about these conversations. If so, please take a moment to leave a review on iTunes or a comment at my blog, www.docsmo.com. And thank you, thank you, thank you for making docsmo.com one of the most popular pediatric blogs in America. Share your insights about the topics discussed. If you have ideas of how I can improve what I bring my listeners or specific topics you would like to address, share your thoughts with me at my blog. My passion is your children and family. This is Dr. Paul Smolin broadcasting from Studio 1E, hoping that you enjoyed hearing this chat about pediatric this and that. Until next time.
I would like to thank the following people for their assistance in the production of this podcast. Dr. David Jaffe, the voice of the introduction. Robert Beezer, the composer-arranger of the intro music. Ann Gesner, my wonderful content editor. Benjamin Smolin and Jerome Moof, the talented musicians who produced this delightful theme music. Sarah Smolin and Nathaniel Horlick for their digital wizardry. And Wendy Smolin Esquire and Seth, the Rocket Man Barrister Jaffe, for their inspirational guidance. Thanks, guys.
By listening to this PEDcast, you agree to all of the terms and conditions found at the DocSmo.com website. This DocSmo.com PEDcast is informational only. Dr. Smolin does not diagnose, treat, or offer specific medical advice for your child. For specific medical advice regarding your child, consult his or her healthcare provider.